Corbin Middlemass here. The Ashes were awesome, but they are over. The good news is the cricket keeps rolling as the focus shifts to the T20 World Cup. Australia is trying to climb back to the top, India is looking all powerful, and England is trying to turn Ashes shame into T20 glory. And did we mention the backroom power struggles? The ABC Cricket Podcast is dropping every Monday and Friday as former opener Ed Cowan joins me to pull apart the juiciest storylines in the game. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Lane Beachley discovered surfing as a grommet growing up in Manly. And to say she took to it is something of an understatement. Lane went on to win 7 world championships, becoming the first woman to do so and the only surfer, male or female, to win 6 consecutive world titles. But Lane's love of surfing was not the only thing driving her remarkable success. When Lane was a little girl, her dad, Neil, told her she was adopted. And from that moment, Lane questioned where she really belonged. She fought hard to prove to others and to herself that she was worthy of taking her place, developing a tough facade both on the water and off it, pushing through self-doubt, chronic fatigue and debilitating injuries to just keep winning. But at this stage of her life, Lane has found how to slow down and really enjoy her place in the world. Hi, Lane.
Hello, Sarah.
Can you remember the first wave you ever caught all the way to the beach?
Look, my earliest memories of surfing actually started on the harbour side at Manly. So my dad put me on a foamy when I was around 3 or 4 years of age, and I stood up on it and waited for the ferries to come in to create that boat wake. We all honed our skill somewhere. And I just fell in love with what I can only explain it as a sense of freedom when I'm on a board or when I'm in the water. Actually, it's my happy place. So I don't recall the first wave I caught or the first wave I rode all the way to the beach. I just know that the feeling that I experienced when I was on a surfboard as a 4-year-old is still exactly the same feeling I have on the surfboard in my 50s.
So was your dad a big surfer?
Yes, Dad was. Well, he's an integral part of the surf lifesaving movement in Manly and actually around the world. He actually travelled around the world as a teenager teaching our lifesaving techniques to Canadians, English people, Americans, Germans. And my older brother, Jason, is a surfer. And so I just, you know, as a young girl growing up, wants to be doing what her older brother does. I do it a whole lot better than he does.
It's got to be special pleasure in that fact.
Yes.
So it was you and Jason and your dad, pretty much the three of you for a long time there at Manly. What sort of dad was Neil? What do you remember about him as being a dad to you?
A tough dad, but a loving dad. He, there's no handbook or playbook to being a parent. And if there was, then someone would make a gazillion dollars from it. But, you know, everyone's just navigating their way and working it out, and we're all products of our environment. So I know my dad grew up in a tough love environment, so therefore my brother and I grew up in a tough love environment. And Dad was very loving, very supportive, but not in a encouragement of words kind of way. It was more of a freedom of expression, clear boundaries, clear disciplinary action in the event that you disrespected those boundaries, but very, very conscious of the environment that he was crafting for us. You know, when Valerie died, which was my mother that adopted me, so Jason's biological mother, she died when I was about 7. And Dad really took the time to create a safe space for us, to make us feel like we were all at home. So, you know, put a pool in the backyard and took us on holidays and just brought us together as a family unit after that devastating loss. So He was a very loving, supportive, nurturing father that gave me a lot of freedom to roam, a lot of freedom to explore the world. I don't know how many dads in the, you know, in the 90s or even late 80s would have said, you know, I said to Dad, I'm going to go to America to compete in the tour next year. He's like, okay, good luck.
Losing your mum at 7 or so, it's such a tender age, Lane. Like, when you look back, what kind of impact did that loss have on the young girl that you were, do you think?
Well, Yeah, I often say that I had the benefit of youth, so I didn't truly understand the concept of forever at that moment in time. But when I reflect back on, like, if I look at any 7-year-old kid that I know and have the sadness of losing their mother, I would wrap my arms around them and just go, you're going to be okay, but it's going to hurt. You know, it's going to hurt for a while. So I remember crawling into my brother's bed, and I remember having a lot of nightmares and just looking for safety, looking for love, looking for reassurance that everything's going to be okay. And I just remember that just heartbreak when Dad told me that she was gone. But I guess one thing I'd really like to go back and be allowed to do is actually attend the funeral. I never really got to have closure because they thought I'd be too young and it would be, I don't know, maybe too hard on me or too traumatic. But not having closure is, I feel, more traumatic than being able to attend a funeral and say goodbye.
Your world was rocked again not long after that when your dad told you that you were adopted. Mm-hmm. How do you remember that conversation playing out?
I remember sitting on the couch and the reason that he decided to tell me a year later, so I was about 8 years of age by this stage, is because kids start asking questions. And when kids start asking questions about my sense of belonging, I started to ask questions because I look very different to my family. My brother and my dad are both over 6 foot. They've got kind of pasty white skin and I've got dark olive skin. I'm only 5 foot and, or 5'5", because that was the goal, and bright blue eyes and bright blonde hair. So just the fact that I looked so different posed a series of questions. And so when Dad sat me down on the couch at home in the lounge room, it just felt like the couch got bigger and bigger and I started getting smaller and smaller. And my sense of self, my place in the world just was immediately shattered. And when he said the words that you are adopted, I heard you've been abandoned, you've been rejected, you're worthless, you're undeserving of love. And that's where my sense of self was rocked and destroyed in that moment in time. And that was not because of the words he said, but because of the story I subscribed to. And that story drove me for a very long time.
Do you remember taking those feelings out with you to the waves, out to your surfboard?
Absolutely. I remember when I joined the Pro Tour in 1990, there was this ferociousness about me. There was this very cocky, arrogant tenacity about I have to be the best in the world. Now, it was a subconscious driver that I became aware of after I achieved my goals, after I achieved my 6th consecutive world title. Because when Dad said, you're my baby girl, but you don't belong here, well, he never said you don't belong here. He actually said, but you're adopted. And I instantly thought, well, I don't belong here. I thought, I know if I become a world champion, everyone will love me. That's the only moment where I'm going to be deserving of love, if I become the best in the world at something. Now, at the time, I wanted to be best in the world at every sport I played. Tennis, cricket, soccer, hockey. But surfing was my number one passion. It was the one thing that I couldn't stop thinking about. It's the one thing I daydreamed about. It's the one sport I wanted to keep coming back to and playing every day. And I decided that I was going to become a world champion athlete when I was 14 in surfing. After I competed in my first event. Now, the first event was a charity event that I competed in, and I came dead last in my first heat.
So how did you make that jump to, okay, world champion?
It didn't discourage me. It inspired me. It made me realize that, yes, I love this. I love competing. I love putting on the rash vest. I love challenging myself against other people and seeing where I'm at. I love being challenged against Mother Nature, and I love immersing myself in this environment. But I've got a lot of work to do, and I'm willing to invest in that to get the work done.
At that age, Lane, at 14, that was also the time that another woman came to live in your house when your dad found love again. How did you feel about having a stepmom at 14?
I wasn't happy. I was not happy about that. My dad has been my rock my whole life, and a woman coming in is basically taking my place. It's kind of creepy, isn't it? But I just saw her as a threat. I saw her as a threat to my safety, as to my love, to my pillar of support. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I realized that it was my judgment of her and my fear of losing my dad that actually pushed him away and prevented me from creating a very strong bond with my stepmother.
I guess that would have also just helped supercharge that feeling, I'm going to do it myself and make my place in the world through achieving and becoming this professional athlete, this pro surfer. But I mean, back then, entering the world of of surfing financially must have been a big challenge. How were you paying for those early years of your career?
I was working four different jobs, and it's interesting that you say I'm going to prove to you that I can do it. And I feel that mentality evolved over a long period of time from growing up in a male-dominated household, losing my mother as a young age, being a tomboy and being very competitive and very outspoken and driven, and then finding or navigating my way through the waves at Manly, which is the most appropriately named beach in the world. It still is a very manly place, and finding my tribe. You know, I was one of maybe three women that surfed at Manly at the time, and it was very difficult or challenging to find any kind of supportive and protective role models and mentors that were my age or, you know, close to my age. And so finding my way, even though it was challenging, and I did have this mentality that you're going to tell me that I can't, I'm going to turn around and say, watch me. And that became my catch cry for a long period of time as well. That was all as a, you know, this mentality that I had to do it on my own because I am on my own. I'm an abandoned adoptee that was rejected by her own mother. I have to prove to you and everyone around the world that I am deserving of love somehow.
What jobs were you working as a teenager?
I was working, was anywhere that someone would have me. So I worked in, of course, a surf shop. I worked in retail. I taught people how to rollerblade because at the back of the surf shop was a rollerblade shop. So I taught people to rollerblade. I taught people to surf. I worked in a restaurant, a cafe. I worked in a pizza shop called Beach's Pizzeria, which was both a blessing and a curse because I got free pizzas, but that made me really fat. And then I worked from like 6 at night till 11 at night making and delivering pizzas. And then I'd go straight from there to my second job, which is the old Manly boat shed just down the street. And I'd work from 11 at night till 3 in the morning.
When were you surfing, given all of this?
Between 7 a.m. and 8:30 a.m. because then I had to be at the surf shop at 9. So there were days when it was just too hard to surf. And then I started training in the early 90s as well. And that training was between 5:30 and 6:30 because our personal trainer, Rob Roland Smith, was also a school teacher. So it was pretty intense. There's no question why I ended up with chronic fatigue syndrome, because on top of all of that, I had no understanding of diet or nutrition or hydration or rest. I mean, there was no sports science. So the only time I ever heard the word core or core strength was being hardcore, and that's what I was.
So that development of chronic fatigue, how do you remember that hitting? Was it all at once, or was it something that was building up in your early 20s?
It was a gradual decline. The body whispers before it screams. And my body was whispering and then shouting at me and then just screaming. And it wasn't until I heard the screams or tuned in to the screams that I was then empowering myself to do something about it. When I did do something about it, it was a moment of truth and a moment of acceptance that I'm responsible for this. I'm responsible for driving myself this hard and pushing myself beyond breaking point.
I guess it's a really hard decision or line to walk for any professional athlete in particular, because part of the job description is pushing yourself.
Yes.
Probably pushing yourself further than average people do, which is why people become so great at something or champions at something. I mean, was that part of what was stopping you realizing that you'd gone too far, was thinking, oh, is this just what it takes to be as good as I want to be?
Firstly, I believe success has to be hard, so I'll continuously find ways to prove myself right, because we'd rather be right than happy. Secondly, every breakdown, every ailment, every injury was just another thing I had to overcome. So I set it as a goal. It became another challenge or obstacle that needed to be fought through, not accepted or navigated or negotiated with. It was just a matter of, I have to overcome this. And the harder I pushed, the more I broke down.
And when you were in the real pits of that chronic fatigue, what did that look like day to day for you?
Well, I don't like to do things half-assed. So the first time it was okay. I just had to go on a very strict diet. I had to get vitamin C injections and vitamin B injections, and it took me a few months to recover. But I like to go through things a couple of times to just, you know, learn the lesson. So
I like to be really good at being having chronic fatigue. You wanted that gold trophy.
Yes, exactly. I wanted another trophy for enduring pain and hardship and challenge. Look how hard it is. I ended up with it a second time a couple of years later because I didn't learn from it the first time. And the symptoms leading up to it were way more severe than the first time. And yet I still chose to push through them and ignore them because I was number two in the world. I don't have the time for this. I don't have the time to listen to my body breaking down. I have to push through and just keep going. And then I ended up in states of depression and suicidality. That was quite scary.
What's the relationship? Because this is a common thing for people with chronic fatigue and other just chronic health issues. It's like, what's that relationship between something that starts in your body or feels like it's in your body and what that does to your mood and your emotions?
Chronic fatigue is a reflection of a bad relationship with my body because I'm mentally overriding everything that I feel. So I'm disconnected. And the more disconnected I am, the further I stay away from healing myself. With chronic fatigue syndrome, I had to learn to accept that I was unwell and give myself forgiveness and then empower myself with knowledge and wisdom outside of myself, reach out for support. So many times I've stumbled through the dark and finding ways to heal and grow. And when I reflect on that period of the second experience with chronic fatigue syndrome, I stumbled for a long time. And I denied myself support and help. And I kept abusing myself and expecting myself to show up where deep down I knew my health was compromised, my mentality was compromised, my relationship with myself was under immense stress and I was in pain. I was struggling. And yet I wasn't willing to put my hand up and ask for help. And when I finally did, the catalyst to putting my hand up was waking up several times throughout a week, waking up each morning and thinking, I can't do this any longer. There's got to be a way to end my life that's not going to hurt. Instead of embracing the fact that this hurts now, but this too shall pass if I'm willing to face it now. And when I rang a dear friend, Joanna Griggs, who was an Olympic athlete and swimmer, and I knew she'd been through a similar situation with glandular fever, which is the precursor to chronic fatigue. I skipped the glandular fever part, which straight into chronic fatigue. Anyone surprised by that? I doubt it. I'm certainly not. And when I picked up the phone, the first thing she said to me was, "Hi, Lane, what took you so long?" So our friends and our family, our loved ones, they know that we're not coping. But we put on this brave face or this facade, and until we're willing to accept the part we've played in it, we will never own it.
It's so interesting, Lane, in that you reach this kind of crux point where you realise that you can't keep forcing yourself to perform the way you've been forcing yourself. But then, what, just 2 years later or so, you win the first of your world titles. So yeah. Explain that to me, that transition from really reaching rock bottom to then getting that goal that you'd been, you know, caning yourself to try and get.
Yeah, caning is a good term. Good word, yes. I did cane myself for the first 7 years with this victimized mentality, this belief that it had to be nothing but suffering and pain. And then in 1996 was when I truly embraced the healing process. In 1997, I came runner-up to the world title for the second time, and once again, I was ready to go. I've come so close, and I can't do this. I'm done. I quit. I set the goal to win my first world title in 5 years. I've now been on tour for seven. It's never going to happen for me. And then I went to Hawaii, which is kind of like a home away from home for me. I love Hawaii, but I always felt really lonely in Hawaii because it was a month away from home, and I just felt like I had no one to share it with. And that particular year in 1997, I happened to just have a sliding doors moment with a man who's a renowned big wave surfer, a guy called Ken Bradshaw, looks and acts a lot like Buzz Lightyear, thinks he can fly around this room with his eyes closed, does have an impressive wingspan. and does come in peace. But it's an intergalactical emergency. But Fuzz or Ken saw in me more than I saw in myself. And we just had this moment where we were surfing together out at sunset and the sun was setting and we happened to just meet in on the beach and we just had a peck on the cheek, kind of kiss to say, hi, it's so good to see you. And we just felt a spark. We felt something was there. And that was the beginning of a love story that also culminated in 5 consecutive world titles. I needed someone in my corner. That's what I realized I needed. So I fell in love with a man, which helped me fall in love with surfing and fall in love with winning. I fell in love with life all over again.
I feel you just took me into a Hollywood movie there, Lane, and I'm just coming out the other side.
Yeah, well.
So you with that love and with that reinvigorated goal, you know, you have this achievement, this, let's begin with the first of your 7 yes. world titles. So what was the biggest feeling in that goal that you'd worked so hard towards and had imagined ever since you were, 14? How did mm-hmm. it feel once you got it?
Relief.
Relief?
Yes.
Not elation or...
No, relief and satisfaction. Relieved because I had been stating to the world and to myself that I was going to be a world champion since I was 8 years of age. And I'm now 26. Relief because since I was 14, I was going to become a world champion surfer. And relief to fulfill that goal and achieve that dream and feel that true sense of accomplishment and satisfaction in that particular moment. Mm. I believe my peers were as relieved as I was because I would shut up about it now.
Did it leave you hungry for more?
Yeah, I became addicted to winning, obviously. Ken actually inspired that too. He literally said to me, obviously you're the best surfer in the world, but you are the best surfer in the water. There's no one that can beat you. So what's your goal now? And so I originally set the goal to beat Lisa Anderson's record of 4 consecutive and then Kelly Slater's record of 5 consecutive. And I thought, I need to become the best of the best. That means I must win 6 consecutive world titles. So then it became a to-do list. Tick, got it, tick, got it, tick, got it. And all the fun came out of it.
The fun came out of the surfing?
The fun came out of the competitiveness. The fun came out of the... It never came out of the surfing, but it came out of the joy of winning. It became a must-do as opposed to I get to. So when I reflect on my world title campaigns, I only remember the world titles based on how I celebrated them. It's the parties that anchored the memory. And I didn't celebrate my second world title. So I actually don't recall winning it. And the only memory that I have of it is based on video vision that I can see. Other than that, I have no memory of it. Other than the fact it was at Sunset Beach.
There was a lot going on with your family too at this point. You know, you had over the years become closer with your stepmom, Christina, but mm-hmm. then what happened to her?
In 2003, which was the same year I won my 6th consecutive world title, halfway through that year, our lives were shattered when Christina succumbed to breast cancer. And it was a period where actually we thought she had, you know, she fought it and went into remission and then unfortunately lost her battle. And it was deeply distressing. And at the time, her daughter or my stepsister, or hang on, what do I call her? Actually, what do I call Catherine? My family dynamic is quite complicated because yeah. my brother was born to Valerie, and Valerie is the woman that adopted me, who then died when I was 7. Then my dad remarried to Christina, and then they had another child called Catherine, who's 18 years my junior. And Catherine and Christina and Dad became a family unit. And then when we lost Christina, I now have a 13-year-old sister who has lost her mother. Mm. And then at the same time, I'm also connecting with my biological mother, Maggie, who lives on the other side of the world. So there was a lot of dynamics going on in the midst of world title campaigns.
Yeah, wow. How much of your energy or attention went that way, went towards what was going on with those shifting dynamics? Or was it something you just blocked out while you were competing?
I'm very good at compartmentalizing. I've learned how to show up even when I don't feel like it and compete to the best of my ability and win, even when life's not great. Mm-hmm. And I must admit, those challenges out of the water were infiltrating my mind and my heart, but I was able to at least block that out for 20 or 30 minutes while I was in the water and just focus on getting the best out of myself despite all of that. But it was hard. It was challenging. It was an emotional roller coaster.
Also in those years, you had found out some details about your birth. Mm. What was the first sort of set of information you got about your biological mum?
I was inspired to find out where I came from when I moved out of home. I started winning, not world titles yet, but I was winning events. So I was challenging the world champions for their place at the top of the ratings. And I started to feel isolated and alone. And I thought, I need to find out where I come from. So in the mid-90s, I applied for my birth certificate. And the information that I received via that certificate put me at ease for a while, because at the time the certificate stated that my mother was 17, she lived in Surrey Hills and she was born in Glasgow, Scotland. And I thought, Dad and I just pieced that together as saying, okay, maybe a Scottish backpacker that just found herself in a compromised situation and wasn't able to keep the baby. And that was enough for me. I was satisfied with that information and felt like I felt a little bit more grounded in myself. Like, okay, I know that perhaps where I come from isn't the story that I told myself up until this point in time. And that's the nature of adoptees too, right? We tend to have a common denominator of rejection and abandonment that serves us, that supports us. We either behave in a way that gives us reason to be rejected, or we reject people first, and it keeps us in the illusion of control. It keeps us safe. It keeps us continuously testing the boundaries. Who's really here for me?
So how did you and Maggie make direct contact with one another?
Mum initially found out who my dad was and made contact with him. Dad knew that I had started searching for her and he didn't feel threatened or intimidated by it. He was very encouraging and supportive of that. And when he was called by Maggie, he basically told her that I was in Indonesia, didn't tell her what I did or who I was or what I'd achieved, and that I would make the effort to contact her when I was ready. So he placed very clear boundaries around that and said, give me your number, I will share it with Lane. When I got home and Dad shared this with me, I called a couple of friends and they all immediately thought perhaps she's a gold digger or a fame digger. The internet had started to emerge at that period of time, so she was able to Google me and find out exactly who I was. And instead of waiting for me to call her, she called me because she wanted to hear my voice. And when she rang me, she attempted to make up for 27 years in lost time in the first 5 minutes of our phone call.
I'm sensing that was pretty overwhelming.
Very overwhelming. And I instantly felt threatened, I felt scared, I felt uncertain, and my normal response to that is to retreat and to shut out. So I basically really just wanted to hang up the phone on her, but I did that respectfully. But I basically said, I'll come back to you when I'm ready. And so I went back to Hawaii and, you know, shared some of this information with Ken. And then what I didn't realize, and because we all have a story, and the biggest illusion in communication is the fact that it's actually been shared. I didn't know her story. I didn't even know what story I had wrapped around it. But, you know, she had just recently lost her fourth husband, I think, or third husband from pulmonary fibrosis. She was just looking for a bit of joy. I can't imagine what it would be like for a woman to give birth to a child and then give it up and not be allowed to touch it or care for it, you know, after giving its life for as long as she did. So I never took any of that into consideration. I just was stuck in my own ego and my own fear, and I just shut her out and I just went, you stay there and I'll come to you when I'm ready. And did that. We played that, well, we danced like that together for a very long time.
Whose idea was it then to first meet in person?
I did want him. I don't know who we give that credit to. I just know we both wanted to meet in person. I know it was my idea to meet somewhere neutral. Mm-hmm. She lived in out Santa Rosa, so outside of San Francisco. I was in Los Angeles at the time on my way home from Brazil. So I suggested that we just meet at the airport. And there was no question she was my mother when I laid eyes on her for the first time. It was like looking in the mirror in 17 years.
What about the emotional language between the two of you. What was that like in that first meeting? Did it feel easy or tricky?
It felt like we both had our defences up. We both felt hurt, perhaps, based on our initial interaction with each other. And maybe we both felt rejected by each other. We never really conversed too much about that. But we sat down and talked, and as Mum reflected, she said it was like two girlfriends catching up. There was a lot to catch up on, and I only gave it a couple of hours. Like, I didn't really give her much time. Like, I'm flying in and flying out. I'm a FIFO for this date. And she was very gracious and giving. But the challenge that I had was that she overshared in her first conversation, and from that moment on, I just had this element of distrust because I didn't want to believe the story she told me. I didn't want to believe that I was conceived through date rape. I didn't want to believe that I wasn't allowed to be kept. I didn't want to believe that she wanted to keep me. There were so many things I didn't want to believe, so I just maintained my distance from her to keep myself safe and to keep myself right. And it took me a long time to realize that the separation that we always felt in our relationship was caused by judgment, and it was caused by my judgment of her story. And it wasn't until I just accepted that her story is her story and my story is my story, and then let's just let that go, shall we, and see if we can reconnect. And over the years, we reconnected. It was kind of like the ocean. We flew in together and then we disappeared and separated again. So there was a lot to discover about each other, a lot to process, and a lot to navigate throughout the years that we spent together.
Hearing that your conception was the result of date rape, that in itself is such a shocking thing for someone to process. I mean, yeah. Just taking that on.
Hi, I'm your mother. You were conceived through rape.
Did she tell you that right at the beginning?
Like, that first phone call.
First phone call.
Yeah, which is why I literally wanted to say, fuck off. I don't have the time and the space for this right now. Let's reconvene. So it was a little overwhelming. Yeah. And Mum would just show up randomly at events and think that was not going to cause any concern, you know. And she'd show up in Hawaii. And fortunately, my friends and my peers would protect me from that. They would make sure that she was out of sight and not let me know, because it would rattle the way in which I performed. It would compromise my preparation. And so fortunately, I would never really see her until after the event. So I was very grateful that my friends took on that role and saw the impact that it had on me and did their best to protect me in that environment and at that time. I believe Mum desperately wanted to be a part of my life, and to achieve that, she would go to extreme lengths, such as showing up to events unannounced, such as making connection with my friends, getting their phone number and then calling them to learn more about me, to calling me at random times at Ken's house or at my place in Australia. There was always just these random conversations at random moments in time that just rambled on. This is not a quality use of my time and energy.
Had she had other children? Had she gone on to have other kids?
So when Mum first called me, she had a 5-year-old girl called Melissa. And after giving birth to me, she was told that she would never have children again, perhaps due to the nature of my conception, but then also how challenging it was to give birth to me. And then miraculously she had Melissa. And then Melissa gets on the phone as a 5-year-old and basically says, "Hi, sister, I love you." I'm like, "Who the fuck are you? Like, this is outrageous." First I'm told I've been conceived through date rape, and now I'm being told I'm being loved by a 5-year-old girl I've never met. This is blowing my mind. I need to go for a surf and try and process this shit.
You and Ken had parted ways, Lane, but you were then set up on a date with Kurt Pengilly from INXS. What were your first impressions of this rock star? How did he look to you?
Yeah, not like the rock star of old, that's for sure. So when I refer to Buzz Lightyear, also known as Ken Bradshaw, I'm glad I got my wits about me and married Woody. That's Kirk. Kirk is Woody. He's very sensible. He's very pragmatic. He's very organized and structured. He loves to plan. He loves to make sure everything's okay. He's very handy. He's very equipped. He's just, and he laughs and loves to make people laugh. So John Stevens became a good friend after I did the Celebrity Grand Prix down at the Formula One race. And at the time, he was performing for INXS. And John thought Kirk and I would make a great match. No idea why, because there's nothing that Kirk and I have in common other than rosé. Now, Ken and I had recently broken up, and Kirk had recently broken up with his long-term relationship as well. So when we met, it was at a private show in Sydney, an event down in Pitt Street, and I stood front of centre at the stage watching John sing and Kirk perform, and Kirk performed barefoot, and I liked to perform and speak barefoot. So I thought, oh, that's cute. There's something we have in common. But I literally kept looking at Kirk and looking at John going, Kirk, John, you're hot. Kirk, you're so not. Like, can I go home with a married guy? Because I'm just not feeling this, John. But I had made a promise to John that I would take Kirk on a date. So I reluctantly walked up to Kirk after the show, and it was Kirk's night. It was all of his mates, all of his friends, and I just kept rudely interrupting him to try and get his attention, and he kept rudely dissing me. Like, I have no interest in you. Hi, yeah, good to see you, but can't you see I'm in the middle of a conversation? Like, no, just give me a number, damn it. He's like, later. Like, who are you, you know?
You're the lady who complains about other people's boundaries here, Lane. I'm seeing...
I disrespected his, that's for sure. It's all my fault. Anyway, at the end of the night, I went up to say goodnight to John, and he said, have you met Kirk? And John actually was speaking with Kirk when I went up and introduced myself back to Kirk for the fourth time that night. And John got all excited, Lane, Kirk, Lane. I'm like, yeah, we've met. And he's like, well, do you have his number yet? And I went, no. He's like, you two, go to the bar, have a drink, have a chat. Long story short, I do get his number from him. I call him a week later, and the week after that I take him out on a date. I took him 10-pin bowling at DYRSL.
You're a classy chick.
All of it low. And then we won one game each, and then we walked from there to DY Beachfront, and I took him to a dinner, a restaurant on the beachfront at DY, and the whole time we're walking there, he's talking to me about surfing, and I'm thinking, oh, God.
He's talking to you about surfing? What, telling you about surfing?
His first surfboard and just his relationship with surfing. I'm thinking,
it's the ultimate mansplain. Lane Beachley being explained surfing.
And I'm thinking, you want me now to talk to you about my first INXS concert that I ever attend? Like, you know, there I am at the front row in my Garfield jumper as a 14-year-old going, new sensation. No, I have no interest in that either. But we go to dinner, and it's a restaurant that's owned by a dear friend of mine. And halfway through dinner, it's obvious that there's no chemistry and no connection. We're literally both there out of obligation to John. Like, neither of us have any interest. Kirk's freshly single and really looking forward to going to South America single and finally making the most of that as a rock star. And I'm really enjoying being single as well. I've been with Ken for 5 years, and I was really looking forward to some Lane time. So I literally went to the bathroom looking for a window to climb out of, thinking if this window's big enough, I'm out of here.
It was that bad.
It was that bad. And Kirk's literally thinking, while I'm in the bathroom, if I just leave money and do a runner, I don't think she'll care. And I gave him plenty of time to achieve that goal. But then he realised his car's at my house and he can't really remember where it is, so we're going to have to walk home together. Fortunately, the owner of the restaurant recognised things weren't going so well, so he brought out a bottle of limoncello, and by the end of the night we'd polished that off and we walked home. I literally was bouncing off parked cars and walls by that stage, zigzagging all the way home. And when we got home, we sat on the couch and I put on Monsters, Inc. I was going through a Pixar phase. Any man out there thinking, gee, she's a real classy, romantic act.
Ten Pin Bowling and Monsters, Inc.
Yeah. And then when I thought he must be sober enough to drive by now, I said, come out into the balcony and kiss me, because if you're a shit kisser, you can go home now.
So are we to assume that that kiss is what turned things around?
Turned things around, yeah. He stayed the night. Nothing happened, but he did wake up alone because I got up at dark and went surfing. And he woke up thinking, oh, this is what I'm in for. And I'm thinking, well, that's rather presumptuous, isn't it? You think you're going to wake up here again? But it did happen. And the next night we went out, he took me on a date to Fox Studios. We went and saw Austin Powers, actually. And that really loosened us up. You know, we got familiar and comfortable with each other's presence and energy. And the reason that John put us together is the reason why we're still together, and that's sense of humour. You know, we both laugh. We both love each other immensely. We have immense amount of respect and admiration for each other. We know what it takes to be the best in the world and everything that comes with that, and the responsibilities and the pressures that are associated with that. But we laugh, we make each other laugh, and we laugh at ourselves and laugh at life. And that's what keeps us going.
Did that relationship help ease the big transition into retirement for you when that happened in 2008?
Yes, it certainly did, because INXS reinvented themselves several times, especially after the tragic loss of Michael. And he was irreplaceable, one of the greatest frontmen of all time. To then have the courage to go on and keep playing their music was a blessing to us all. So Kirk is just, he's such a grounded soul. So seeing his ability to adapt to being on stage in front of thousands, to them being at home doing the washing, he's just a remarkable soul about how he adapts to change. And so, yes, it inspired me to see life outside of surfing. Now, that didn't mean it made it easy. It just gave me a real grounding force, especially in the days when it was hard. And it took me probably 4 to 5 years to adjust and adapt to not being a professional surfer anymore, because I had been since I walked out of high school.
Nearly 10 years after you retired, Lane, you got a call from your birth mum, from Maggie. What news did she have?
Yeah, so I retired in 2008, and then in 2017, Maggie rang me and out of the blue and said, "They've given me 3 weeks to live. Will you come and say goodbye?" I'm like, "Oh, man, thanks." Like, that's not the phone call I was expecting. And Maggie and I had been through a pretty tumultuous journey at that period, because I had come to the realization after writing my book, my biography, I'd come to the realization that my fear of connecting with mum was founded in my fear of loss. Like, I equated motherhood with loss. So I lost Valerie, I lost Christina, and then mum, when I first met her, was also HIV positive. So I knew it was just a matter of time before I lost her as well. So I was afraid to connect. And so when I received this phone call, I did not hesitate. I booked a flight and flew out the next day, because 3 weeks, you don't know how long they're going to be conscious when you've been given 3 weeks to live. And I'm really, really grateful that I did that. Like, I just put everything aside. Now, in the lead up to that, over the years, I had attempted to reach back out and seek connection with her. I sent her a card explaining, saying I'm sorry and explaining why I did the things that I did, basically saying I was never trying to prove you wrong. I was always trying to prove myself right. And I sent her, you know, a necklace saying, "I love you, Mum." It took a lot in me to say Mum, because I didn't trust him, that word Mum. And then her response to that was, "Thanks for your note. Thanks for the gift. Don't know how I'm meant to take it." So I was rejected time and time and time again. So it was a great teacher. She was a beautiful teacher for me in dealing with that rejection piece and navigating my way through that. Long story short, when she called me, I jumped on a plane the next day, flew to Spokane, and I read in my diary yesterday about what was going through my mind. And I wrote, "There's so little I know about my mother, but now it's too late. So I just have to connect with what I do know and connect with what I do want and find some level of safety and I don't know, a joy in that, because it's too late to ask these questions."
So when you got there, Lane, to her bedside, was she conscious? Could you talk?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So when I arrived at the hospice, she was unconscious but had the ability to be conscious. Now, she was drugged to the eyeballs because she had do not resuscitate as part of her advanced care plan. And so it was just a matter of time. So when they said, "You've got 3 weeks to live," I think she ended up passing away within that time frame. And I'd written in my diary, she looked a lot better than I expected her to look, but she was extremely frail. You know, she was just gaunt and looked like a skeleton, but she still had colour in her face, and her eyes hadn't completely sunk, and she still had the capacity to communicate. So I'm very fortunate that my sister and I, Mel, my half-sister and I, actually had those last moments of life with Maggie. So if anyone's ever had the deep misfortune of having a bedside vigil with someone they love, there's this moment where they just spark up and you think, wow, they're actually going to be okay. But that's the last spark. And we got to share that with her.
For a relationship that had been so difficult or turbulent at various times, was there something comforting in being able to have that final time with her?
Yes, very comforting. Just to know that we were able to settle our differences, forgive each other, just reassure each other that we loved each other, and then let go.
Mm. Makes so much sense when you said a moment ago that the word mum was, you know, such a charged or difficult word for you, given that you'd had the loss of a mother after a mother after a mother. I mean, how do you hold that word now, mum? What's it mean in your mind?
What does it mean? I think, you know, every woman is a mother, even if they don't have their own children. I think, you know, each one of us has a nurturing quality. That's why we're women. We are the architects of the future. We are natural nurturers. And I think about, you know, through my Aim for the Stars Foundation over 15 years, I pretty much mothered over 500 women. And then I have been mothered by my girlfriends and my girlfriend's mothers, and then I've nurtured and mothered others as well. So I think if we just limit the term mothering to being a maternal provider and protector of your own offspring, then I think we're limiting the interpretation of what mother actually means. And I'm very fortunate also that I get to immerse myself in Mother Nature and Mother Ocean every single day. So I embrace motherhood now more than I've ever have, because I have a better understanding of what it actually means for me.
Where else do you put your energy now, including all that competitive energy that had driven you for so long?
Well, I'm attempting to slow down while I'm ramping up. So when I retired from the Pro Tour, I staged the richest surfing event in the world, because it had to be the biggest and the best, which was a successful event for 7 years. And that essentially created a platform of growth and enhancement for women surfing. I also had my own charity for 15 years. I had my own clothing brand. I was investing myself in paving the way, because, like I said earlier, I stumbled around in the dark for so long, and there was no handbook. There was no particular modality that helped me every time. I had to draw on resourcefulness. I had to draw on connection and asking questions and curiosity and reaching out and asking for support. And then I created my own little pathway, which then has led me to then creating the Awake Academy with my business partner, Tess, because we want to help people help themselves. And that's what inspires me today. Is that's where I'm channeling my energy and all my emotion and my competitive nature. Is as I continue to know myself and grow myself, I help others know themselves better and grow themselves more. And as we do that, we get to live our best lives. But it's not easy. It's none of it's easy. It is quite a challenge, but it's something that I'm passionate about, that inspires me to wake up every day to be a better human being, because I want to help people help themselves.
It's interesting what a change it sounds like you've made from this very solo sense of me against the world, me
yes.
triumphing, to this collaborative way of approaching things that just seems to be at the heart of the way you think about life now.
Absolutely. And you're right. I've always been a solo artist, and to be able to now share the stage with someone that I love and admire and respect and learn from every day is such a gift. It's extraordinary. I mean, Tess has such a remarkable story, and we bring the best out of each other. She's one of the greatest dream team members you can ever ask for. So I feel very blessed to be doing this work, because I became the best of the best, and I want to help people be the best of their best. Mm. They don't have to be the best in the world. I could easily just retire and rest on my laurels and go surfing and travel the world with Kirk, but giving back is what motivates me to get up every day and do what I do.
You've spoken about these three mothers that you've had across your life, Lane. You've also had this dad, Neil, right, from when you came home from the hospital. What are things like between you and Neil these days?
A little challenging. My dad has Lewy bodies dementia, so he had a fall on Father's Day in 2025, and that pretty much took the wind out of his sails, where he has lost the ability to converse. He listens and he knows you're there, but he can't really communicate that well anymore. But the last faculty to go in every one of us is love, and he is still very loving. He's still the same man inside. He's just not the same man on the outside. So he loves women. He loves pretty girls. I'm pretty sure he thinks I'm an ex-wife because he always wants me to give him a kiss and hold his hand, and he keeps kissing my hand and kissing my arm. And he's got a ravenous appetite. He's 87, just turned 87 yesterday, and is fighting on. You know, we thought we were going to lose him late last year in 2025, but he's continuing to fight on and just still has a lot of love to give and a love to share. So I'm very grateful that my rock is still hanging in there. You know, he's not letting go anytime soon.
We began by talking about your dad putting you out on a foamy when you were a kid in Manly. Is the water still somewhere you spend a lot of time?
The water is still my happy place. When people ask me, where do you feel most at home? I say the ocean. I'm still very blessed. In my 50s, I surf every day. I basically structure my life around the surf forecast, and it's a place where I process my pains, I heal my hurts, I celebrate my successes. It's a place where I just go to experience a true sense of freedom. What I love about the ocean and what I love about surfing is it continuously teaches me the art of surrender, and surrender and acceptance ends all suffering.
I think about the theme of belonging that's been there for you for so long, and it's like the ocean is the place that you can always belong.
100%. It's a beautiful teacher, because whenever I question my sense of belonging, all I have to do is immerse myself in the ocean and I'm right back home.
Well, you get back there, Lane Beachley. Thanks for making time for conversations amidst it all.
Thanks, Sarah. I need to go for a surf now and rinse that all off. Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Lane Beachley's new book is called Awake Academy: Know Yourself, Grow Yourself, and Live a Happier, More Purposeful Life. And it's written with Tess Brower. This conversation was produced by Maggie Morris and recorded on the lands of the Gadigal, Turrbal and Yagara peoples. Our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.